Welcome to On Being Happier, Thinking with Heart and Mind, a podcast emphasizing the heart's role in happiness, in sound decision-making, and in being at our best. Hi, my name is Ron Schneebaum. I'm a physician, work at the outpatient arm of the Children's Hospital at Dartmouth, and serve on the clinical faculty at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. I'm convinced that nothing's more important to the human psyche than love. I've worked at thinking with both heart and mind for over 40 years. While intellectual analysis generally carries the banner of thinker, to leave out the heart is to leave out something vital. Language reminds us of the importance of the heart. To do something half-heartedly or to not put our hearts into an activity means we didn't do it well. And to be heartless is not a compliment. We involve our hearts wherever we care the most, where heart and mind work together, we're happier, have richer relationships, and greater practical success. We are fully present and we are fully ourselves. It's the art of living well. Each episode of this podcast presents a different aspect of thinking with heart and mind. Together, I hope they paint a full and broad picture. I developed this podcast to not only describe a lost art, but to also offer challenges and tools that interested listeners can use to incorporate thinking with the heart and mind into all aspects of their lives. The ideas in this podcast are my own, and the stories have been altered to protect privacy. This podcast is not a substitute for medical advice. If you are experiencing significant difficulties, please seek professional help. I thank you for joining me on this venture. My very best and be well, Ron. Episode 8, The Psychology of Heart and Mind. A 17-year-old came to see me because her anxiety was increasing and it was becoming hard to manage. She would cry intermittently for no reason, and she was having a hard time falling asleep. She was afraid that she wasn't living up to her parents' expectations. She thought her grades weren't good enough. She worried she wouldn't get into the college that she wanted, and she thought her friends didn't like her. Being home alone during the pandemic had made things worse. She said that she'd been anxious since she was a little kid, but she only started to talk about it recently. She noticed that when she spoke to her friends about what was going on, or when she spoke to her stepmother, she felt a lot better. These periods of feeling better only lasted a short period of time, and I thought that counseling would help her. I also thought that medication could also help to take the edge off and hopefully help her sleep better and help with her crying. She denied being suicidal and wasn't worried that she would hurt herself. As our conversation progressed, she told me a story that occurred when she was about 5 or 6 years old. I was standing in my bedroom, and my mother was yelling at me. And suddenly the strangest thing happened. Everything around her became black, and I only saw her face. Her face was all distorted. Her eyes looked funny, her mouth looked funny, and I just felt she was really mad at me. She said it was a horrible feeling. She also said that her mother was always mad at her. Well, it didn't take much to link her feelings of insecurity with her mother's attitude and approach. When I thought about it later, I wondered how, in the best of all worlds, she could heal these past hurts to such a degree that she'd feel strong in herself, like herself, develop good relationships, and enjoy life. I knew this was possible, I just didn't know how, and then I made some discoveries. These discoveries formed the basis of what I now think is a new psychology, one that is built in the idea that full human thinking includes the heart as well as the mind. In this episode, I'll describe these ideas, how I came to them, and how anyone can apply them to their own lives without needing a particular belief system nor practice. My first insights into the idea that we think with both heart and mind occurred during a long walk at the beach. I was doing some writing on happiness and needed to grapple with some ideas. Sometimes I like to take long walks to do that. It was a beautiful summer morning just after sunrise, and there was nobody at the beach except for a few dog walkers, an occasional fisherman, and myself. As I walked, a thought immediately came to mind, the words, know thyself. It seemed a good place to start because it's such a respected idea and comes filled with the insight that knowing ourselves is key to happiness and wisdom. I worked with this phrase for a while, and then a second phrase came to mind. I can know the self. My thinking went that if I can know the self, then the I and the self have to be two separate and discrete entities. You can't know something unless you're separate from it. An old philosophy joke came to mind. Two fish were swimming, and one asked the other, "How's the water?" And the second fish said, "How should I know?" I knew I'd come across something important. I just didn't know what it was. To confirm this, I looked at language, and I saw that indeed there's a difference between the I and the self. I can be pleased with myself. If I make an effort to get something done and stick to it and succeed, I'm pleased with myself. At times, if I worked at something and tried to remember not to do something and by mistake did what I'd hoped not to do, I'd be mad at myself. And sometimes I'd decide to better myself. I'd want to change certain things for self-improvement. As I considered these, it seemed that the I serves as the judge, the jury, and the director of the self. And then I realized that we spend a huge amount of time trying to please this I. It can be subtle. Sometimes I'll walk past a mirror and have a little beauty pageant there. We can also strive to please this I, and insofar as we do that and we establish ourselves, we become proud of ourselves and think of what we've achieved as defining who we are. To please the I, we can also put down others, and by putting down others, we establish ourselves in good standing in front of this I. So if I put you down and I stand on your shoulders, I am better than you. It didn't take too much to see how conversation is constantly filled with gossip and put-downs, with the idea of making ourselves better than those we put down, even if we don't do this consciously. Seeing the relationship of the I to the self also highlighted a question that I had and put it in a light that I hadn't previously understood. Besides the girl I described in the beginning of the episode, I'd seen abused children, both in my practice and in my life, who found themselves at fault for what happened and suffered because of this. It made no sense to me that they would find themselves at fault, but that's indeed what happened. I met a woman on the second leg of a flight to Florida, for example, who seemed to be in her mid-30s, was very chatty, and told me her life story. "I'm just coming back from a residential drug and alcohol treatment program," she told me, and she was on her way to returning to her home in Florida. She said she had the best job that she could imagine. She headed a large tennis program at a tennis center, oversaw the teaching, and she also oversaw exhibitions when touring pros came to the area, and she'd sometimes play against them. She was the only child of two alcoholic parents, and when they drank, they got ugly toward each other and also toward her. She remembers not uncommonly to hear her parents say, "We wish we never had you." In high school, she knew that she had to get out of this house, and she devised a plan. If she worked hard academically and really worked hard at tennis, she could possibly get a tennis scholarship, which is exactly what she did, and that's how she landed this job. At one point, she fell in love with a guy who drank more than he should have, and she drank with him. When she drank, her old feelings of seeing herself as worthless rose to the surface. She couldn't tolerate it, and drinking was her only way of easing the pain that she felt. The part that struck me was, when she was older, she knew that she wasn't at fault. She knew she was a good kid. It was her parents who were alcoholics who were the problem. In addition, she set up a plan for getting out, worked hard, and succeeded at it. Instead of being able to see that what happened to her wasn't her fault, and that she actually succeeded at what she had done and could be proud of herself, she couldn't dig out from the hurt and pain of being judged by this inner aspect of the I, which took what happened in the past, buried it deep within the psyche, sealed it in there, and seemed to make it inaccessible to healing. While we try to succeed in the eye of this judge, we might, but success doesn't equal happiness. There are places where we fail, and failure in the face of this judge goes deeper than face value. If I'm with a group of people and seem like I don't fit in, that I'm kind of not really in the conversation, I can feel terrible about myself. I can think there's something wrong with myself. I don't just see that, well, maybe I don't really connect with these people. if a group of friends go somewhere and don't invite me. Instead of just feeling a little lonely, I'll again think there must be something wrong with me, and this can crush me. My mother almost committed suicide because of this. She had failed the licensing test to be a teacher in New York City and was so distraught that she was sitting on the windowsill of her apartment ready to jump. The Avon lady saved her life. The doorbell rang, and for some reason my mother decided to answer the doorbell. The woman selling cosmetics saw how upset my mother looked. My mother had invited her in. The two of them sat down and had tea together, and she made my mother promise that she wouldn't hurt herself. My mother's pain came from the fact that along with her failure, every other failure that she ever experienced in her life was as alive as it ever was at that moment. She was the youngest child in a family of seven, a very poor family that had immigrated from Russia, and she was the only one born in this country. Her father died when she was young, and to eke out a living, her mother had to work, leaving her two older daughters in charge of caring for my mother. My mother also remembers her mother as being cold, and she even thought mentally challenged. Putting all of this together, my mother saw herself as unworthy of being loved and unloved, and she carried this with her till her death at 95. Instead of looking at that teacher's exam failure as simply a test that she could take again, she saw herself as a failure, and it hurt so much she wanted to end her life. Her insecurity that stemmed from her childhood wasn't eased by the fact that she had a husband who adored her and two children who loved her. I knew that there had to be a way out. There had to be another way of viewing the human self. That wasn't something that I got to understand until several years later when I was revising the piece I was originally working on and again took a walk on the beach, this time specifically to try to understand how I could look at the self differently. I knew that it wasn't only like this. After a very short time on this walk, an image came to mind. I pictured a child of about 5 or 6 sitting on a step by themselves, crying, with an adult walking by. And I realized an adult who saw a child crying in that situation, who was mentally intact, would stop what they're doing, and they would go and see what was the matter and see if they could solve the problem. Now, in order to do that, they'd have to do several things. First, they'd have to care enough to want to invest the time and energy. Then they'd have to try to find out what exactly happened, and then see what happened from that child's perspective. So if the child dropped a piece of candy into a mud puddle, the person would have to understand how devastating that was to this child at that moment. Once they connected, different solutions could be found. If we've ever felt compassion or love, we have within us the ability to help another. Whether we use it or not is akin to saying we all have the capacity to speak a foreign language, and not all of us use it. We can understand another because we are essentially different variations of the same human body. To be dramatic to make the point, it's not as if some of us are whales, lions, and some of us are snakes where we couldn't possibly understand how the other functions. We all have the same body with its different variations. We also have what I call the same life forces, the unconscious processes that keep our bodies alive and have to do with our health and well-being and how robust we are. We vary in this as well, but our similarities allow us to understand another's perspective and experience. We all have the same kinds of experiences, either inner experiences with relationships or outer experiences where our bodies go into different environments. And there, too, we can understand each other. We know this because we can read a book about characters that are unlike us, or listen to a song or watch a movie, and connect with those characters. We can even sense whether the writer did a good job in creating that character, whether it really holds true, even if that character lives in a way that's completely different from the way we do. When we work on solving a problem with the involvement of our hearts, we leave our own perspective to see the matter through the eyes of the other. We don't go alone at such times. Love joins us. It's love that does the actual healing. This isn't meant to be flowery or sweet. It's a psychological fact. A parallel can be seen in cleaning off the windows in a room with caked on dirt. As we scrape away what's there and let in light, we aren't the light, we do the work that lets the light enter. The love that passes between us and fills us is as solid and as real as the ground I stand on. It's universal. A conversation with a child, an effort to help a child who's crying, could take place anywhere on earth and in any culture. This love is also transcendent. We could comfort that child at any time throughout history. This love takes us out of ourselves and we feel strengthened. We feel this whenever we connect with another through love, either through our own compassion or through receiving love. Some feel it in times in nature, some when petting their dogs or cats, and others through reading, through music, through art, and through spiritual practices. When we connect to this stream of love, we feel good. That's why it feels good to help another and to connect with another. We can also take this ability to be compassionate, this ability to pour in love, and turn it inwards, looking at our own former selves and the place where we have our psychological pains and hurts. This is the answer I was looking for. It's what could have helped the girl that I mentioned at the outset, the tennis player, and my mother. So now we see that there are two ways of thinking. We can think with critical analysis and judgment, what I call the mind, and we can think with compassionate understanding. Two of them together create full human thinking. Imagine this as a keyboard. If there are the high notes and the low notes, to think only one way limits our possibilities. When we develop the other side, when the two are equally strong, we can play according to the needs of the situation, we can play our own tune, we can be in flow. The intellect is the focus of formal education. There's almost no real training in developing insight into others and compassion, so it takes work. Language tells us that compassion and love come from the heart. This is obvious, really. And we see this in everything from seeing somebody in the distance, we want to let them know we love them, we pound our chest, or even our emojis point to the heart as being the source of love. And when someone is academically and intellectually smart, say that they're brainy. These aren't extensions of the same thing. They are two opposite things, just as the left foot is different from the right foot. And using both allows us to go forward optimally. Now, I wonder, why is it that, as we said in the beginning, a general tendency is to think through the eyes of this judge? Why is it that children can learn without being taught that they're at fault when bad things happen around them? I can't know, obviously, but when I wax poetic, I think that in this is the key to human freedom. I can't teach a lion in the jungle that it should live a more peaceful, vegetarian lifestyle, nor can I teach my cat not to hiss when it gets upset or my dog not to bark. But we can work toward including both heart and mind in all that we do. By doing that, we'll create greater happiness than we previously imagined possible. Our relationships will be richer, our connections deeper, and our success in the world will not only grow, but will create the structures that will allow us to thrive and in the best and fullest sense of the word. I believe that learning to think with both heart and mind is a challenge of our time, and it's something each of us as individuals can strive to achieve. I create this podcast to not only review this idea of thinking with heart and mind, but to also offer exercises for interested listeners to use to turn these ideas into practice in their lives. So for this episode, there's a three-part exercise. The first part is to think about whether you think that the ideas presented here are true. Does thinking with the heart, with love and compassion, differ from what I call thinking with the mind, with critical analysis? Consider thinking with the heart and thinking with the mind in your own life. Where do they intermix? Where is one stronger than the other? The second part of the exercise is to look at the role of this inner judge in your life. Here, we're not interested in bringing up old feelings. Just as an athlete can look at videos of performances to see their mistakes and work to improve them, here we're just looking without dredging up the old feelings. It's just to see the role of this inner judge and how big a factor it plays in our life. obviously here, only go as far as you can. You might find that doing this work with a friend is easier or with a mental health professional. Don't go further than you can. But look and see how much you had judged in the past. How much do you judge others? And then experience feeling judged. How does it feel? In the name of clarity here, being judged differs from being corrected. Being corrected helps with growth and ability. Being judged, it doesn't help. The third part of the exercise is to look at the role love plays in your life. Have you ever experienced feeling love? How does that feel? Have you ever done something for someone else purely out of human kindness? Again, what's the inner experience for that? Would you enjoy your life more if you let more kindness, caring, and compassionate insight into your life? How might you do this? Now, please note, these are simply thought exercises. You needn't make any changes. Over time, when some ideas become clear, you'll notice you'll put them into play. But at this point in time, just consider. To help interested listeners with these exercises, I've also listed the exercises in the show notes. You can read them and even download them. At the bottom of the show notes, I have several quotations about working and thinking with heart and mind. I find them inspirational. I hope you like them. The show notes can be found at the homepage of where you listen to podcasts or found at the podcast website's homepage. In addition, at the website of the podcast at ronschneebaummd.com. And if you can't spell Schneebaum, which means snow tree in German, the website can also be reached by searching for onbeinghappier.com. You just need to have on being happier as one word. At the podcast website, I have a picture with the words, The Psychology of Heart and Mind. There's a larger size picture and a smaller size picture. The larger size picture can be downloaded and used as a screensaver for your tablet or laptop. The smaller one can be downloaded and used as wallpaper for your phone. I find that having the words of something that I'm working on is a helpful reminder. If you have any questions about either the content or the exercises, please email me. You can reach me at ron@onbeinghappier.com. I recently appreciated how simple it is to do this. If you are now sitting with a smartphone or a tablet, you can just say, Siri or Alexa, send an email. And then it'll ask where the email is to, and it's ron@onbeinghappier.com. For the subject line, write questions. If you have comments or suggestions about future podcasts, in the subject line, write comments or suggestions. In addition, I will be sending out a monthly newsletter. The newsletter will have some of the background material for some of these podcasts and also news about the podcast. If you're interested and would like to be on the mailing list, write mailing list in the subject line. The mailing list that I developed will not be shared with anyone else. It's completely private and completely protected. I plan on posting new episodes of this podcast around the 1st and 15th of each month. Some of them take a little bit longer to develop and they're a little bit later, but during the time between podcasts, think about these exercises, work on these ideas, and start to develop tools that you can use in everyday life. If you're streaming podcasts, instead of just going from one to another, spend some time with this podcast and the thoughts in it so that, again, as I said, you have tools that you can use. If you like this podcast, particularly this one, because this one presents ideas I haven't seen anywhere else, I would really appreciate it if you share it. Share it with friends, share it with family members, share it with colleagues, share it with therapists, with teachers, with anyone who you think might have an interest in its ideas. Another way podcasts get known is by going to the homepage of where you listen to podcasts or to the Apple Podcasts homepage, rate it and review it. I appreciate the time that we spent together. I look forward to our next time. Until then, all my very best and be well, Ron.